Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding people better. To learn more about it, go to behavior-podcast.com. In this episode, I talk to Philip Furley, who's done a wide range of interesting sports psychology-related research. He's done so much interesting research related to the role of nonverbal behavior in sports, it was honestly hard to decide which topics to focus on and which questions to ask. Here are some of the topics we talk about. We talk about positive and negative body language in sports and what effects that can have on one's teammates. We talk about celebratory body language and how that can influence the perceptions of other people, including judges. We talk about some behaviors and strategies of penalty kickers and goalkeepers in soccer. We talk about some specific behaviors from the recent World Cup games. We talk about the challenges in finding general behavioral patterns in sports. We talk about anxiety and the role it can play in sports. And along the way, Furley and I talk about various ways someone might make practical use of his research findings. I want to give a big thank you to Alan Crawley, who I've previously interviewed on this podcast and who goes by the online handle SinVerba. It was Alan's idea for me to ask Furley for an interview, and Alan also came up with most of the questions you'll hear me ask, because he's much more familiar with Furley's work than I am, and also because he's a lot more familiar with the game of soccer. So thank you for all of that, Alan. If you're interested in learning more about nonverbal behavior, I highly recommend checking out that talk I did with Alan. It was one of the more popular episodes of mine lately. And if you're interested in sports-related psychology specifically, just to note that I've done quite a few sports-related and game-related episodes in the past. Just a heads up before we start, this podcast has some ads. If you want to subscribe and get an ad-free version of this podcast and get a few other features like collaborating on upcoming episodes, getting a free copy of my depolarization book, and more, you can learn more about that by going to behavior-podcast.com. Aside from any benefits, you'll be supporting me in making this podcast better and in promoting it. So if you've thought my work on this podcast has been interesting or important, and you've enjoyed all the free content I've put out, maybe you consider signing up. Okay, here's the talk with Philip Furley. Hi, Philip. Thanks for coming on.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So maybe we could start with talking about your interests a bit. What is it that's driven the various kinds of research you've done in the sports field and elsewhere?
Yeah, okay. I didn't really get into the stuff we're going to be talking about till a bit later in my scientific career. So I started off my PhD in 2009. That was more on cognitive topics like how you can control your attention in various sports settings. And then in Germany, after you finish your PhD, if you want to become a professor, you have to do something called your habilitation. And there I got very interested in the social psychology of sports. And that's when I started to research into this nonverbal behavior and nonverbal communication, body language stuff. So what I noticed is a lot of people talk about that in applied settings, sport commentators. But then when I had a look, reviewed the literature, not that much research had been actually done in the field of sports. I mean, it was a very mainstream topic in general psychology, but within the field of sport, not that much research had been done, which was a good starting point for me to get started in this field of research.
So one of your areas of research has been the body language of players, sports team players, and how that can affect their teammates or opponent players, for example, by communicating confidence or lack of confidence. Can you summarize? I know that's probably a big ask, but can you summarize your views about the role body language plays in sports?
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, it's hard to quantify it. I mean, several things we were interested in our research. First of all, the first thing is how body language is affected by various situations in sports, like, for example, the current scoreline, how it is going at the moment for the team, for the player, and if other people can recognize this sort of just based on the body language, and then in turn how this again might affect other players, opponents, spectators, and then again in the long run how that might again come back to affect sports performance. These were sort of the questions that we were looking into. And I mean, we've got some answers to these questions. So what we find very very clearly is that the nonverbal behavior, the body language, the facial expressions, they are very much affected by various things that are going on in sports. One thing we had a look in a lot of different situations. So players change their body language if they're currently doing well, if they're leading, or if they're currently trailing. This is something that we've always found in all the experiments we've done. We've had to look at that in soccer, in tennis, in table tennis, in handball, in all sorts of different contexts. And this is something that we can clearly show. The body language is affected by how it's going. So if you are not doing so well, this shows in your body language. And if you're doing well, this also shows again in your body language. And people, observers who are not especially trained in drawing inferences from nonverbal behavior, body language, can make accurate inferences. If you show them brief video recordings or photos, they can say, okay, this guy is leading, this guy is trailing, and also by how much they're trailing. So one finds quite a contingency between the nonverbal behavior and the current score line. In further experiments, we could also show that this can have an effect on other players. So, for example, if you put athletes in a hypothetical scenario and tell them to look at this player and how likely they're going to play well or play poorly against this player, then they're a lot more confident playing against somebody whose body language is from images where they're currently trailing as opposed to where they're currently leading. To give you one example of a line of research we've been doing.
To take a specific example, in one of your studies on baseball, you discovered the importance of holding your head high. Could you talk a little bit about that specific finding?
Yeah. This was an experiment we did with actors. We used the so-called point light technique there, where we just put markers on joints of people, and then we manipulated sort of the body language they were doing. This was a follow-up experiment from the research that I'd been talking about before. And then if we manipulate the body language to resemble the body language of a trailing athlete, that sort of looks a bit more submissive as opposed to dominant, then you could clearly tell that the observers form very different impressions. So if you showed these point light images to observers, also to athletes, then they had a negative image of the athlete that was sort of looking downwards, that was sort of collapsed, didn't have a lot of body tension. And they were also a lot more confident to interacting with this athlete. For example, if it was a pitcher, then they were a lot more confident that they would be able to hit the ball, hit a good strike with the baseball.
So one thing I've wondered is how would you implement this in a real world setting? So let's say you were a basketball coach, let's say, and your team had been losing for a while in the game. If you could give advice to the team, what kind of would you suggest that they change their body language? How would you suggest they do it? Would you suggest maybe they just avoid expressing negative or losing appearing emotions or gestures, or would you suggest they maybe fake some nonverbal confidence and things like this?
Exactly. I mean, it's not an easy question to answer, and one doesn't want to encourage sort of unnatural and bit freaky gestures and body language. So, I mean, what you do find in a lot of our research is that the body language is sort of automatically affected by how what's going on. And you can get sort of into a downward circle, huh? That it's going poorly. This shows in your body language. And then, this might sort of affect your teammates and boost the confidence of your opponents. This is something that we can sort of simulate in the experimental research that we've been doing. And of course, applied work wants to look how you can interfere in a way with this negative cycle. So, I mean, being aware of what's going on is, of course, something, a first important step. And then I think it's important to sort of, if you notice that things are going poorly and sort of you're losing tension and this shows in your expressions, then it's maybe important to sort of take a deep breath, step back and sort of refocus, maybe use some positive self-talk to get out of this vicious circle, if you want, mm-hmm. That you sort of say, okay, sort of kind of a fresh start, gather yourself and then maybe take a deep breath and try to sort of get into a more positive posture, because one knows there are all these feedback loops. It's not a one-way street. It's not only that the situation affects your nonverbal behavior, but also the other way around. Then there's feedback from your body. And if you sort of intervene here and sort of try to adopt again a upright posture, chin up and gaze up, then I think you can have positive influences on your body language. But it's not that trivial. Huh? This is something that you do have to probably work on, that you do have to train. You have to notice when something like that's occurring and then try to sort of break out of this and get refocused.
Right, like you were saying, it'd be, you know, I think some people would think, oh, I'm going to fake being, you know, having really positive body language or whatever. And I think, yeah, what you're pointing to, it would be strange to fake that. Like it would come across as artificial. So I
guess,
yeah,
exactly.
Avoiding the obvious, you know, it's almost like you just have to, it's almost like taking the advice of having a positive mindset, and like that will naturally leak out to your body language, I would think, yeah.
No, exactly. And I mean, it's simplistic messages like that are something that I don't go for. I know this is something difficult. So my goal as a scientist is trying to understand what's going on and then giving some helpful advice that might actually help. So we've also looked into the question whether you can sort of distinguish between expressions, body language, exaggerated body language, and body language that's actually affected by circumstances in sports. And people are very good at detecting these differences, which would speak against sort of just trying to fake it and act, mm-hmm. act too dominant, too confident.
Right. That makes sense. So do you have a sense of how big of an effect we're talking? I think that'd be a lot of people's question is, you know, it's probably like in the scheme of things, it's a, you know, a small percentage, but still that can be significant because in a lot of games you are talking about very close games. So I'm curious, do you have a sense of like, you know, say the difference between a team with like very bad, you know, beaten body language who really lets it show versus a team that's more cognizant of these things? Do you have a rough guess of how big of a percentage it would matter?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to give you a percentage. I don't think one can sort of answer that with the methods that we have in science. I mean, you see all these messages that sort of a lot of the stuff that's communicated is most of it nonverbal. I'm not really sure how they came up with these percentages. So I can't really speak to a percentage. I think it, as you were saying, I think it's very important. It's one of these many variables that has an influence, and they're not isolated. Huh? They belong to the sort of to the whole toolbox. And I think this is one that hasn't been addressed enough by research, and that applied coaches, sports psychologists can do a lot with. And so I consider it very important, but sort of in combination with different things. Huh? It's sort of you have to get into the right inner state. This is likely to gonna affect your body language, your nonverbal behavior in a positive way. And if you notice that if you are in a good state, but your body language can still be improved, I mean, this is something else you can work on. Huh? This is another thing that you should pay attention to.
Apart from the nonverbal, have you done any research or seen any research about the role of, you know, verbal encouragements or how people talk to each other? Has that been part of your work?
Not really so much of my research. I mean, recently we were asked to contribute a chapter on communication, and a big part of that was nonverbal communication. And yes, I mean, obviously what people say to you, what coaches say to one has a big impact. It also matters how they state things, sort of in a calm, not too agitated way. I mean, these are things that have been studied, but not so much by me and my students.
You had done some research on surfing and how surfers' body language can influence observers and judges. Could you talk a little bit about what you found with that research?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was more of a bit more applied question, not so much the basic research I'd been talking about before. Yeah, I'm very interested in the sport of surfing. I got into surfing myself when I was going to school in San Diego. I'm not very good at surfing, but I started to follow it quite actively. So the contests are broadcasted also in Germany via the internet. And so I've been following it quite a bit as a spectator. And one question that arose there was that it's always one or two surfers, one to three surfers who are competing against each other. And then the two best waves, they surf, are scored by a judging panel. And then they get points for the waves. What then often happens is that a surfer gets the first good wave and the other surfer has already two good waves. So he needs another score to beat the other surfer to progress in the heat. This is kind of the format that exists there. And then they've got a limited amount of time that they have to get the two best waves in a heat. And then the scenario actually always occurs that one surfer needs a certain score to beat the other surfer. And what you then often see that the time runs out, so the surfers take off on a wave, and then at the end of the wave they show some very interesting nonverbal behavior in the surfing situation. They call them claims. They show some victorious nonverbal behavior, like punching in the air, doing fist pumps, this kind of stuff. And they do that sort of towards the judging panel. And something that they always said in this commentary is that these nonverbal celebrations, that they affected the judging panel, that sort of they didn't really judge the performance, but sort of how
how they thought they did.
How they thought they did, exactly. And this was sort of a question that I thought we could answer very well with some methods that we've been using. So we had a whole lot of video material from surfing contests. And then we could have this video material judged. We could judge the actual performance. And then we could see how much the judging was affected if he showed this additional victorious nonverbal behavior at the end. And we got quite a clear answer. So we did, a good experimental setup, and we could clearly show that both lay people, when judging the performance of surfers, they judged it more favorably if the surfer celebrated their performance with a certain nonverbal gestures. But it was quite interesting that also experienced surf judges judged it about half a point, which is quite a lot in surfing, better when they saw these victorious nonverbal behaviors after the wave, in comparison to just seeing that performance without the nonverbal behavior at the end.
Yeah, I mean, that seems pretty huge. And I mean, getting back to that question of, is it a good strategy to deceptively do these things? It would seem in this case that it would be a good strategy, with the caveat, of course, like the other things we were talking about, where, you know, at a certain point, if you're known for somebody that's always behaving triumphantly, everybody will know that about you. So it kind of would get out that you were often doing that. But it seems like in the context of a specific, you know, event, there wouldn't be much reason to not try to act more confidently and triumphantly after your...
Yeah. No, I agree. So sort of up to a point, exactly. Because, I mean, in these videos, we did have the surfers actually did do something well that they thought they should celebrate. And then, I mean, the comparison was showing this or not showing this. So the message would be, so if you do well, then I think it's beneficial to show this. But if you're doing poorly, I think judges
don't know. Notice, huh?
And it would, I mean, spectators would pick up on that, and you might get a bit of a weird reputation. Which
you're phoning, you're just a faker. You got to use it within reason, basically, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you have
yes,
to
exactly.
use it judgmentally. We're like, you could have actually been proud of that.
Yeah. No, I think exactly. That's what I would say. That's a good way of summing it up. So if you've done something good, I mean it helps. It can help to show that to people around you who are watching, but within limits. If you've done sort of okay or not so well, then it wouldn't be advisable to try to fake it.
Yeah, then you just get viral videos of yourself doing a very bad performance and celebrating, right?
It could end careers.
So what about the when it comes to some of the similar kind of displays that some teams do? Like, for example, the New Zealand rugby team does the haka, and there's other teams that do collective exhibitions of unity, hugging themselves, chanting before a match, things like this. Have you done research on how those things affect or intimidate rivals, affect performance?
Yeah, not directly. I mean, some research that touches into that. And I think the haka is a very good example. Huh? It's very impressive. And I think, I mean, it's something that's grown culturally in the natives of New Zealand. Huh? I think things like that have a long tradition in all sorts of cultures with two intentions. First of all, to sort of psych one up oneself, to sort of get the team ready, sort of kind of a pre-performance ritual that gets you pumped up, ready to perform, ready to fight in these matches. And on the other hand, it has the effect to try to sort of intimidate, scare the opponent. And if it's something that's sort of grown with these cultures, with the All Blacks in New Zealand, it really is very impressive, and I've got no doubt that it has intended effects and that it does help the team. But again, I don't think it's enough to sort of say, okay, New Zealand does that, sort of we should start this as a team oneself. It has to be authentic, it has to be believable, it has to be sort of suit the team that's showing it. And there's all kind of research showing that sort of pre-performance routines can increase arousal, can increase performance. So I think teams are well advised to sort of try to train something like that, to engage in things like that. And if it's something like the haka, I think it's likely that it could also have the effect of scaring the opponent a bit, intimidating the opponent, making lowering their confidence. And we've done some research, or there has been some research that has shown that the way that, for example, tennis players enter the court does affect sort of confidence levels of the opponent if they come in very confidently. And also from my own sporting experience, I can remember sort of looking at some teams, looking at some plays, and thinking, "Oh God, how am I supposed to beat them?"
Is part of the what do you think the intimidation? Because it seems like there can be a few different routes of intimidation there. I mean, one of them is just feeling like, "Oh, the other team gets along better; they're tighter knit," and that can be intimidating. Do you think that's this kind of like social perception that they're closer and have more in common? Is that part of the intimidation?
Yeah, I think that's a interesting point. I would believe so. There's some very interesting research. I always wanted to try to sort of do something in sports with that actually shows that things like having rituals where teams move together, that this increases team cohesion, that if they do engage in something like the haka, moving very synchronously, that this in fact does lead to a bigger belonging to the team, sort of less me, less I in team.
And like brainwashing. kind of like group cohesion activity. Yeah,
kind of, I think it's quite likely. I don't think it's been shown, but I think it's a very feasible hypothesis that this would increase team cohesion. And again, I mean, if people actually feel that sort of, I'm really part of this team, I'll do everything to help this team. I mean, I'm pretty sure opponents will notice that. Teams that are sort of very close together, functioning very well as a team.
Mm-hmm. One body.
Yeah. Opponents are bound to observe that.
Mm-hmm. So you've gotten a good amount of attention for your football-related work, aka soccer-related work. Maybe you could give a summary of the work that you, the most important work as you see it in that you've done in the area of football.
Well, football, of course, is something that's very big in Germany, and often, I mean, the actual sport isn't sort of what I'm so interested in, but sort of using it to test theories in psychology. So we've done a lot of research on football penalties, but mainly because this is a very good situation, I find, to study body language, study nonverbal behavior. First of all, it's quite a static environment, well-controlled environment, two players playing against each other, where you can monitor both the goalkeeper and the penalty taker very closely. You can see, watch the facial expressions, the body language, and it's got a very clear outcome. It's a very easy to study environment, much easier than studying 11-on-11 soccer. So this is one of the reasons we've done so much research here. So we've looked at several things. So maybe I'll stick with the work on nonverbal behavior that we've done on body language. And here in combined work with some other European scientists, we were able to identify one kind of nonverbal behavior that's clearly related with being not so successful, that shows that you are anxious. And this is something that we've called hastening and hiding behavior. And you can see that quite often in situations where a lot of pressure is on the performer, and they show behavior sort of trying to get out of this situation as quickly as possible. And in the soccer penalty kick situation, you can see, first of all, before very important shots, like in penalty shootouts, when you have to score in order to keep your team in the shootout, you find that you can monitor this hasting and hiding behavior. And this usually shows in the penalty taker when he's placed the ball on the spot, that he turns his back towards the goalkeeper and walks back and then turns around again. So he turns his back towards the goalkeeper, which we say he's sort of hiding a bit in front of the goalkeeper. And then the hastening comes that when the referee blows the whistle, so there's always a signal in the penalty situation, then the players sort of see that a bit like the starting shot in a 100-meter dash, and they immediately initiate their run up, and both of these behaviors.
That's hastening as opposed to taking their time.
Exactly. Then
the
sort of waiting a bit, looking at the goalkeeper, and you can find that both turning this back and sort of initiating a run up immediately when the referee blows their whistle. Then this is associated with poorer performance. And we've also done more research that this creates negative impressions in observers, in goalkeepers, and has various ways of negatively affecting the performance. Yeah, well, maybe this hastening and hiding, we haven't only looked at that in the penalty kick situations. We can find quite a few sporting situations, like free throws in basketball, performance in darts, always been in these self-paced situations. This hastening usually leads to more negative performance. And otherwise, I mean, these are the two behaviors that you could show across a whole bunch of penalty takers, that this seemed to be a general pattern that is negatively associated with performance. Often you find that players show sort of individual things that distinguish only within that player between when they're performing successfully as opposed to performing better. So we don't find very many general behaviors that always are associated with negative performance. It's something that's quite individual, so it makes more sense studying that within a person. this is something that we are doing at the moment because we haven't been successful sort of finding a facial expression of success, finding a body posture of success or body posture of failure. This is something that seems to be quite individual and something that we couldn't find. So in science, you're always looking for these general laws, but this seems to be something that's quite individual.
Yeah, I guess it it gets into, you know, these things are often so much more complex than they seem. Like there's multiple ways to be anxious. You know, there's like an anxiety that can cause you to rush something. And then there's the anxiety that can cause you to prolong something. You know, there's different ways it can play out.
Completely. And this is something that was a bit frustrating at the beginning because that's something that we were looking for. But just as you were saying, there are these well-known videos, at least in Europe, with Zinedine Zidane actually throwing up before important penalty, but then scoring an amazing penalty, which is clearly a sign that he was feeling very anxious, but he still could pull it together and perform well. So it's not as easy as one would like to have it sometimes, that you can find, okay, this kind of behavior is going to lead to that.
Right.
This is something that we haven't found.
Yeah, that's actually something I was talking about with Alan Crawley, who helped me write these questions, who researched some of these questions and was more familiar with your work. We were talking about some athletes, some high performers of any you know, area, sports or otherwise, will be more likely to be very calm under pressure. But then there's some people that the anxiety is what drives them to perform well. So there's this, you know, this spectrum. It's not, like you say, it's not easy to pinpoint like what mental state will lead to what, you know, success or failure. But I'm curious, do you have a sense? Because I would guess that the people that are more kind of unnaturally calm under pressure would be more likely to be overrepresented in you know, sport, high performing sports or athletes. But I'm curious, do you think that bears out, or do you think there's just as many people who in sports who are successful that are anxious and driven by the anxiety?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think it would be very similar to the normal population. At least this is something what one hears from applied sports psychologists, that a lot of very high performers, they sort of dread it very much when an important performance is coming up. But they can still do very well in these situations. They do feel the nerves, they do feel this arousal, anxiety, but can somehow keep it together. Huh? And some people in some situations can't. I don't think it's something that elite athletes would be different to the normal population. I mean, obviously the ones at the absolute best, they are at the absolute top because they succeed in the situations when it matters the most. But I mean, it's hard to pinpoint why that is the case. Huh?
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the hastening and hiding behaviors of, let's say, penalty kickers, I'm curious, would that be a situation where you would advise avoiding those behaviors, or is it maybe another case of where, you know, that those people are anxious, so they're probably going to have the outcomes of anxiety no matter how they, you know, pretend to perform? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, those are things that you also see a lot less now. So the first person who actually spoke about that was Norwegian sports psychologist Geir Jordé, who we've also done some research together with. We sort of followed up on his work, and he also works with several national teams. And since this has been published about 10 years ago, it's become a lot less, less that you can see that in the top penalty shootout. So people seem to become aware of that, and this is something that they that they train, that they try to avoid, that this is something that is not beneficial to performance. So it makes sense to try to build that into your pre-shot routines. Don't show these behaviors. So you can control control these things. And like that, you sort of have things you can focus your attention on when you're in a very stressful situation that you can control and that have been shown to be negatively linked to performance.
So would that mean in the case of hastening, would that mean that players are no longer rushing as much and they're taking their time more than they did before? And is that helping their performance?
Yes. I mean, this is something that you do see, that people in these high pressure situations, that they do work on routines, that they've got a planned concept in their mind that they focus their attention on. And the good thing about that is that it focuses their limited attentional capacity on something that they can control. Put the ball down, face the goalkeeper, take 5 steps backwards, referee blows the whistle, take 3 deep breaths, and then strike the ball in a certain corner. These are things you can control, as the positive aspect that you don't sort of focus on what might happen when I miss the shot, on worries, ruminations, and sort of it also helps to control these aspects of your nonverbal behavior. So all likely to have beneficial effects in these situations.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to goalkeepers, one paper suggested that staying in the middle is the optimum strategy. In another article, it suggested that goalkeepers should distract shooters. And I think you suggested that waiting longer to react may be helpful. In your opinion, when it comes to goalkeeper strategies, do you have opinions on that area?
Yeah. I mean, those are all strategies that have been published in good journals. I mean, that's always what happens. So experiments, they focus on 1 or 2 variables and then maybe lead to a recommendation that doesn't take all the variables in play into account during actual match. So, I mean, staying in the middle, that's, I think, a study of Michael Bailey a couple of years ago that shows that in the soccer penalty situation, goalkeepers show something like a action bias, because sort of not acting in a situation like that would be something that is socially not wanted. So they tend to always jump into one corner. And that's why penalty takers can exploit this by shooting in the middle. And you can increase your chances by waiting in the middle. So this can be strategy that is helpful in some situations. It should certainly be part of the goalkeeper's repertoire. He should not always dive, but sometimes also stand in the middle. I think that would be good advice. And then there's a lot of other research. For example, I mean, we did some research that shows that sort of drawing attention from the penalty taker towards yourself by waving your arms or doing some kind of behavior draws attention towards you. And then there are studies that show that when attention is fixed onto the goalkeeper, then sort of the aiming behavior, the shots also tended to be placed a little bit closer to the goalkeeper. So a strategy where you draw attention of the penalty taker, then it makes sense to wait a bit longer, because it's not so likely that a very accurate penalty is gonna happen right next to the goal post. Then you can increase your chances by waiting a bit longer and then trying to save the penalty like that. And there's also other research that was done. It was initiated by Rich Masters, who's now in New Zealand, that could show penalty or goalkeepers can also stand a bit off center. Sort of they can move themselves a tiny bit off center so that it's hardly perceivable by the penalty taker. And then they can't really say that the penalty, the goalkeeper is off center. But if then they sort of implicit
that direction,
notice something, and then statistically significant, they shoot more towards the corner with more place, and then sort of the goalkeeper exploiting that and diving to that corner can be a good strategy.
That's interesting.
So there are all these indications from research which goalkeepers can try to exploit in their behavior. I mean, one important thing that one has to look at, and we've also done some research in this area, is that there's sort of two different strategies penalty takers usually take. Sort of the goalkeeper dependent one, looking what the goalkeeper is doing and then shoot to another corner, or the goalkeeper independent one, sort of predetermining where you're going to shoot and strike the ball as hard as you can. And if you hit it properly, then the chances of the goalkeeper are not so good. So the goalkeeper has to try to identify which strategy the penalty taker is likely to take. First of all, by studying this penalty taker, which is his preferred strategy. And then there are behavioral cues that indicate which strategies he's going to take. For example, run-up speed is one. If he runs up a bit slowlier, then it's more likely he's going to do the keeper dependent strategy. And I mean, this is all something that goes very fast, but these are little bits of information that can sort of help to increase the chances of saving a penalty kick. So if you see that the penalty taker is going to take a keeper dependent strategy, then it's advisable to wait as long as possibly, get him nervous, sort of the goalkeeper's not deciding, and then trying to react to that. These are sort of pieces of information that you can use. And if you know a penalty taker usually takes a keeper independent strategy, then you can try to do this off-center technique, stand a bit away from the middle. And then research shows he's more likely to shoot the open corner and then jump as hard as you can to the other corner. Like that, you might be able to increase your chances a bit.
Yeah, regarding that, I wanted to read a quote from apparently the only goalkeeper that stopped a penalty from Messi during the World Cup. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, Szczęsny, maybe. He said, now I can say that I knew where Messi would shoot, but at the time I wasn't so sure. Leo looks at the keeper on some penalties and hits hard on others. I knew that if he was going to hit hard, it would be more to my left. I saw that he was not stopping, so I went, I sensed, I defended, end quote. So he had studied Messi and discovered a bit of a pattern there. But I thought that was just interesting for being related to what you were saying about studying it when you can, if you think there's a pattern there.
Yeah, and I think that's a nice anecdote, sort of speaking to that. I think you can find individual cues within a player that would point to sort of likely behaviors he's going to adopt, like the one that the Polish goalkeeper recognized in penalties run-up. And I think it makes sense sort of studying videos of individual players and then trying to determine patterns in what they're likely going to do. This makes a lot more sense than saying, okay, sort of having a general strategy over all players. I think it's these nonverbal cues are much more likely tells if you study individual players. There's also this nice story that I talk sometimes about when I'm lecturing on this to my students. I think it's in the biography of Andre Agassi, who said he found a tell in the serve of Boris Becker, who usually pointed his tongue out before he served the ball. Mm-hmm. And then sort of if you pointed the tongue out straight, then the serve was much more likely to go straight than when he pointed the tongue out sort of in an angle, then he would more serve to the outside. And I think that's also quite a nice example how individual players study the mimics, the nonverbal behavior of opponents, and can find patterns. But we as researchers have found very little patterns that always point to a behavioral outcome following a certain nonverbal behavior.
Yeah, it's complicated. I'll throw in there too that I did a previous episode. I interviewed a tennis coach, Carlos Goffi, and we talked a bit about that Andre Agassi, Boris Becker tell. I'll just throw that in there. But yeah, it's difficult because there's so much variety, and in a lot of cases, the practical approach is just to play the most game theory optimal approach, because kind of all the factors that can kind of break down, and you're left with just like, well, I should just do the best strategy for this moment, regardless of what the other person is doing or what I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there was a recent controversy over Argentina goalkeeper Martinez during the World Cup. What's your opinion about, if you know about it, what's your opinion about his verbal and nonverbal methods of distracting Netherlands and France's penalty shooters?
He got a lot of bad press about it, and players certainly liked him less. And on the other hand, I mean, if the main goal is to be successful, he was very successful. But this is something that I mean, I don't like to see. I mean, it's borderline unfair what he did, I think. I mean, he used behavior that was sort of at the limits of what's allowed.
What was he doing?
Well, he was trying to distract the penalty takers every chance he could. Huh? I mean, he did that, what I was talking about before, sort of getting the attention of the penalty takers, trying to bring them out of their routines and very vivid behavior that.
Was it like offensive behavior, or was it?
No, but it wasn't actually offensive behavior. I mean, he wasn't showing gestures that are actually offensive, not allowed, that have to be sanctioned. But it was sort of the whole time at the border of what is allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he, and then also, of course, when they received the award, he was also behaving badly. So in general, I mean, he performed extraordinarily well, but I mean, he'll only be remembered for this bad behavior that he showed there. And it would have been nicer to win without that, I would say.
Yeah, it reminds me, in poker, there's what they call angle shooting, which is a term for things that are not technically illegal in the game, but are perceived as immoral by, you know, a good number of people and outside the realm of proper game etiquette. So it sounds like it was in this kind of gray area of, yeah, sure, it's allowed and you might do okay with it, but people are going to frown on you and look down on you a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what it was. It was sort of, not gentleman-like behavior. Yeah. And I mean, this is something that, obviously, I mean, sport is very competitive also at the highest level, but you don't want people winning like that. And I also don't think that was the reason they won, but it was sort of a negative, I don't know the English word, it had a negative
connotation.
Touch to it, connotation. Yeah.
So in one of your, in a 2016 study, you found that when the nonverbal behavior of the referee is perceived by viewers as less confident when they decide a foul, for example, players were more likely to argue with the referee, in contrast with when he called a clear foul, when his body language was more more confident. So that would seem to say maybe it would make sense to teach referees to have some confidence in their calls, but, you know, like we've been talking about, that could backfire, because if you do that on a clearly wrong or close call, you know, you might lose respect from people. Do you have thoughts on the practical benefits of that research?
Yeah. So it was several experiments we did in this paper. So the first, we wanted to sort of check, I mean, we thought referees would be a good group to do research on, because they actually get trained in this facet of nonverbal communication. They get seminars and sort of nonverbal behavior experts come to them, trying to teach them to communicate their decisions in a confident manner. And sort of part of this research was looking into, okay, how successful is this coaching? And what we did there is we recorded, or we took television recordings of referees, and we knew, of course, the situations that they were communicating. And so we could distinguish situations that were absolutely clear. So we tested that, and situations that were not so clear. And what we did then, we had people rate the body language of the coaches. And there we found a quite clear pattern that when they were communicating ambiguous decisions, difficult situations, their body language was less confident, sort of speaking in that direction that we do have this automatic tendency when we are not so sure about something, that this shows in our facial expression, this shows in our body language. And this is something that people are equipped with. This is sort of comes with the evolution of people. We do communicate how we're feeling inside, even if we don't want to. This was sort of an instance of that in this first line of research. And what we then did is sort of we created a hypothetical scenario again and then showed different videos of referees who just given a yellow card or a red card or given a penalty and then told players, okay, this was sort of a 50-50 situation. How likely would you be to contest the call of the referee? And there you could clearly see, okay, if a referee was from one of these videos where he was communicating an ambiguous situation, but the people in our study, of course, didn't know. They were a lot more likely to argue, to debate with the referee, showing that, we do have this natural tendency of showing how we're feeling inside, and this can have negative consequences on the playing field. So the referee might be more likely to lose control of the game. So, I mean, again, I don't think they're quick fixes for that. I think it's interesting to understand that. And I do think that referees are well advised to work on this, and I'm sure they do. And one does have to find ways of then sort of interacting with the players, even if you are not sure in this situation, by trying to communicate it. Communicating it in a confident manner, but also sort of being authentic and sort of then trying to create understanding in the players, sort of maybe telling them, talking to them, why you decided like that. Yeah, being sort of human too. I mean, people come with this tendency that they do show that in their body language.
Mm-hmm. Gets back to the theme we've been talking about a few times, where it's like you can use some of this knowledge to your benefit in various ways, but you also have to be aware that using it badly will have repercussions for you.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And exactly, because I mean, humans aren't perfect. Huh? I mean, referees are getting assistance now from technology, which I think is a good idea. Huh? That you can't see everything that's going on the pitch. And then if you have methods of reassuring yourself with a video assistant referee and things like that, that's beneficial. Huh? That will help the referee, and that they won't be so often in situations where they made a call that might have been wrong, but then they can sort of correct it later. This is likely to cause less friction on the playing field. Mm-hmm.
Would you like to talk about any other important work that you've done in sports behavior? Or do you think we've covered a good amount of it there?
Yeah, I think we've talked about very interesting work. I mean, can maybe talk a bit more about ongoing work that we are also doing. So we're also trying to use a lot of technology now to sort of automatically trace facial behavior during sports competitions, and trying to find contingencies between that and working on automated ways of detecting certain behavioral patterns like posture during game situations. This is something that's interesting, that's also a lot of fun, but we're still quite at the beginning of that. And also, I mean, here, for example, I think you mentioned that you also have a poker background. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah, I used to play for a living, and I'm most well known for my books on poker tells, poker behavior. Yeah,
exactly. So, I mean, we've also played around with that. For example, I mean, there's so much interesting material you can use in this research. So we've used these facial emotion recognitions on thousands of images from poker players, for example, when they've got a strong hand, when they've got a weak hand. Mm-hmm. And So I haven't found any contingencies there that there might be something that's associated over the players when they are bluffing in comparison when they have a good hand from this facial recognition software. This is something that we've looked into, and we've also tried to find facial patterns. For example, if a penalty taker scores a penalty or misses a penalty, and also there we haven't found much.
How can people keep up with what you're doing now?
I always try to publish the work that I'm doing. I mean, that's always slow. Mm-hmm, the scientific publishing always takes quite a bit of time. I upload all my studies on ResearchGate. Mm-hmm, so at least if the journals don't get rid of the articles again due to copyright things. But people can also always send me an email if they're interested in the research, and I can send them copies of the papers.
If you do ever want any help on the poker related research, I've written some critiques of past poker studies. I've also helped people who've done poker behavior related studies. So just throwing that out there, if you ever just want some help on anything,
let me know. That'd be actually really interesting, because as I was saying, at the moment was more playing around. We've got interested students who wanted to do that, and it's quite easy to get some of the footage. Yeah, I'd be very interested, and I'm always looking for interesting avenues for new research.
Yeah, I've always been surprised there aren't more studies where involving poker, because it's such a interesting, and very formal environment to study some very specific behaviors. And I think, well, one of the reasons is it's hard to set up the game, and to do your own setup of a game is difficult. Has a few factors there, but I think it's a great opportunity for studying very specific situations.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, especially the nonverbal behavior. I mean, this is something, of course, that you link very much with poker. And what I find great is that nowadays you've got all this video footage, and if you set that up well, I mean, it's actually all there, and we've got tools for analyzing facial behavior. We've got tools for analyzing body language, and it's just interesting to gaining a more systematic understanding. And at the moment, I'm quite confident that you don't have these universal tells or something, but you can find interesting patterns within an individual depending on the situation.
I will say, just not to get too much off on a tangent, but I will say the big challenge with using the footage that's out there is that one of the most important places to find poker tells is when someone has bet, made a significant bet. And then in televised poker footage, the usual editing or directing approach is to cut away from the person who has just bet. So that's one of the most frustrating things for me as someone who's made videos, is like they always cut away at the most interesting part when you want to study the person who's just made a significant bet, so anyway, not to get off on a tangent, but
that's good. Yeah, that's,
there can be challenges there. And that's, I actually said that in my Poker Tells video course, because I use a lot of televised footage in that. And I say, like, it's frustrating because I would have a lot of things to show you here, but I can't, because they always cut away from the players. Anyway, this has been great, Philip. Thanks for coming on. And I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun, and very good questions.
That was sports psychology researcher Philip Furley. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. You can learn more about this podcast at behavior-podcast.com. If you enjoyed this episode, just a note that I've done quite a few sports-related and game-related episodes. I've done talks on reading behavior in American football and tennis and mixed martial arts, and a couple episodes on poker behavior. Thanks again to Alan Crawley, also known as Sin Verba, for his research and help with this episode. If you enjoy this podcast, go to my website, behavior-podcast.com, for some ideas on how you can show your support. There's an option to subscribe to get an ad-free version of this podcast. Please consider sharing episodes with people you know. That's one of the most appreciated things you can do to help me out, just sharing episodes you like. Okay, thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.